Let us convene the House Committee on Human Services. Welcome, everybody, on Monday morning. Many of you have been waiting for this day, for the long-awaited end of the reign of my co-chair to the left. No, it's not true. But she's been very patient with me, and I hope you will be as well. This is my first time to chair the meeting, and here we go. I want to make sure you know that on House Bill 2051 and House Bill 2052, we just discussed this, and we will not be holding a work session today. So if you're here for those two bills, relax, put your feet up, and enjoy the committee, because it's going to be a lot of fun. And what I think we'll do is carry them over until Wednesday, those two bills. So I hope that's clear. Now, we're going to wait for Representative Gilsford, correct?
And go ahead. No, we're going to go into the
session. So we'll wait for her for later.
Yeah.
She's not here. I would probably recognize her. And we're going to go ahead, as you can see on your agenda, with the informational meeting. And surprise, surprise, so I'm opening up that informational hearing on self-sufficiency and temporary assistance for needy families, otherwise known as TANF. And we have with us again, I hope you're getting overtime, Erin Kelly Seal, the Assistant Director of the Department. And take it away. We'll appreciate it.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Erin Kelly Seal. I am the Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. I'm an Assistant Director in the Department of Human Services. And as Representative Gilliam has referenced, hopefully today will be the last time that you have to see me. I'm planning on covering two major sections of work within our division today. We carried over the child welfare overview from Friday, and if you...
Okay. I've already neglected something that my co-chair is very good at. Somebody probably has a BlackBerry, Blueberry cell phone. Would you just double-check everyone to turn those off? Because obviously we got some interference. Is everybody off? And mute won't help. Totally off. Sounds a little better. Maybe. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. So I'm gonna do my best today to keep a close eye on time and fly through two presentations. With your permission, I will start with the child welfare program overview. And since some of this you heard on Friday through the bill presentations, we should be able to go relatively quickly, and you've seen the presentation, so just to catch up on a few things. Within our division, we do have responsibility to protect kids, and we consider it primary as part of that responsibility to preserve families. Our authority to intervene in the life of a family really only begins if a child has been abused or neglected. And so when there are sometimes serious concerns about a family and about maybe something that's not going as well as it should in a family, really the threshold for us is there needs to be an immediate harm or an immediate safety risk to a child before the very heavy hand of government intervention in the life of a family would begin. We do, though, welcome and want Oregonians to let us know if they have concerns about families, because we want to be sure that if there is an opportunity for us to supportively help a family that who is struggling, that we take advantage of that and that we protect kids. And so we actually see it as good news. I guess this isn't up on your screen yet. But I'm working off of the PowerPoint for the child welfare programs, which you received last Friday. And on the first page of that PowerPoint, there we go, you can see that the number of reports to us about concerns relating to kids continues to rise. It goes up steadily every year, and we consider that a good thing. We'd rather have people call than question themselves and not call. It gives us a chance with our expert eyes and ears to hear the information, we do a screen to see, is this a report of abuse or neglect, or is it another kind of concern? If it's another kind of concern, we're able to offer that reporter alternatives and referrals to other kinds of supports that maybe they could support a family with. If it is a report of abuse or neglect, then we have authority to investigate. We have tightened up our timelines in the last several years for investigation. And we have made our investigative process more comprehensive in nature. So the evaluation isn't just, did a child get hurt at that, or was a child at an immediate safety risk, but we really comprehensively evaluate the situation concerning a child. That came out of several, about five or plus years ago now. There were several instances of child welfare having received reports, having done what we call kind of a more incident-based review of the situation, and then the child ultimately suffered serious harm. So we ended up changing our look at families to become more comprehensive. And we've done that, though, in conjunction with a very serious effort, as I said, to preserve families and to keep children with their parents if at all possible, even if we confirm that a child has been a victim of abuse or neglect. So I'll talk more about that later, but we have the number of victims in Oregon of child abuse and neglect also continues to rise, unfortunately. We are, on any given day in Oregon, serving around 8,700 kids in foster care. That's a lot of kids, and those are kids for whom we actually have had court we actually have court involvement. We have legal custody. No child enters or exits the foster care system without a court order, without us having had to prove to a court that we've met the legal threshold. So this isn't just our opinion that abuse or neglect has happened and that there's an immediate safety risk, but in fact there's a series of legal criteria that we then take to courts with district attorneys to prove that the state can intervene in the life of a family in this very serious way by taking legal custody of their children. And so we take this very seriously. Once that happens, that child can either sometimes, with court approval, remain at home with a court-approved safety plan for the child, or they are placed, if we can't keep them safely at home, in a foster care setting. And we are also working really hard if we have to remove a child from their parent to be sure that we have located relatives early and, if possible, we're actually placing children with a family member as opposed to a stranger in foster care. One of the things I think people struggle to keep in mind when they think about children in foster care is that it is our legal obligation to help that family be preserved and to return that child to their parent. And so the focus of our efforts is really on reunification. And as you can see, in 2010, 63% of kids who had a foster care experience and left foster care went home to their parents. That's not something that's usually the public imagines. They often imagine a child going into adoption or guardianship. Most of these children go home. And for us, that speaks to the need to really think about what can we do to make these parents, to support these parents in a way that helps them to protect and keep their own children safe. Because ultimately, as I said, that is our legal responsibility, and it's most often what happens, and as the longitudinal studies are showing, it's really best for kids. The number one issue that drives child abuse and neglect in this state is alcohol and drug. We are very fortunate to have an attorney general in the state who appreciates addiction issues as a public safety issue. And he has spoken often about A&D and also domestic violence, and indeed those are the two largest stressors presenting in families who ultimately have children who are abused or neglected and who then require our intervention. So those, as we think about how do we prevent abuse and neglect in the first place, which is, of course, any of our ultimate aim, if we could get a handle on drug and alcohol addiction and really better intervene early in the families' lives who are struggling with domestic violence, we could keep children safer. We do have a serious problem in Oregon, as we do across the country, in that children who are African American or Native American are represented at higher rates in the foster care system than they are in the general population. We call this overrepresentation. It's a disparity that we are not proud of. We call the numbers out because it's important that we recognize that our efforts in the past to reduce foster care have had some success with white families primarily, but we need to address and approach the issues of families and preservation of families of color differently and in a more culturally responsive way. And thus far, up until last year, we were really struggling in that area. One of the good news points about our data from 2010 is that we saw a significant decrease in the number of Native American children experiencing foster care. And on the other side, we also saw the number of African American children who were entering care, that's not a statistic here, begin to decline. So when you look at this statistic about the same 8.3% African American in foster care as in 2009 looking the same, what that tells me is that we need to do more to help those children exit care, because we are beginning to make some progress on what we call the front end around foster care entry. Always a big concern is that there are kids who are older in foster care who grow up there and who leave foster care and requiring some additional support as they transition into adulthood. This just describes for you the number of youth that we saw transition and who received independent living services. We continue to strive to increase that number. Another thing that is really important as we go between the conversation today on child welfare and self-sufficiency is that...
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know. Sorry for the abrupt interruption. On the previous slide, we're talking about the apparent decreases in percentage among some of these populations. I'm wondering if the numbers are going down or if the major group of people has rising numbers and thus causing a decrease in the percentages there.
How about we have an actual chart that I just don't have here, and so I would love to send you a chart that describes the picture more completely. Would that be helpful?
Yes.
Okay,
thanks.
We'll do that. Another myth that we are currently looking to debunk in the Oregon child welfare system is that all children are in child welfare primarily because of physical and sexual abuse. That's in fact not true. Nearly 50-plus percent of children experience abuse, who experience what we call abuse or neglect, more specifically experience neglect or threat of harm. And that requires a different kind of intervention when you're thinking about what's going on in a family where it's an act of omission as opposed to an act of commission. And so this drives some of our conversation and is driving it increasingly as we look at the connections between poverty in particular, addiction, substance use, and domestic violence, and what some of those major drivers are. This is not to say that people who live in poverty aren't great parents. There are many, many, many excellent parents who struggle with their resources and who are living in poverty. However, there is increasingly data that shows that children who live in poverty are at higher risk than children who do not of maltreatment and in particular neglect. And so when we think about an opportunity again to prevent child abuse and neglect in the first place, our conversation about poverty and anti-poverty programs is really important. When you look at just the Oregon TANF program, our Temporary Assistance for Needy Family programs, as compared to what's going on in child welfare, we know that nearly 37% of children in foster care had been on TANF in the previous 2 months. Up until about 2 years ago, when our caseloads were lower in the TANF program, we had invested in a very strong program around child welfare risk and intervention in families on a voluntary basis. We call it Family Support and Connections. The waiting list for that program, it has nearly doubled over the course of the last 2 years, and therefore we're seeing more and more families in the TANF program who are at higher risk of struggling to keep their own kids safe, and we're also at the same time watching the number of kids coming into the child welfare program who had previously been in TANF go up. And again, it's just an opportunity as we think about the policy ramifications of investment in different places, for instance, our self-sufficiency programs versus child welfare, and where we can actually begin to get ahead of this problem. We have made, over the last several years, we've created for ourselves a series of strategic goals in child welfare designed around best practice, what we're learning about families. Historically, I think that child welfare was known as more of a child rescue-based system, and we are really attempting to shift our model toward a family preservation model that works as hard as we possibly can to preserve families, keep them whole, and hopefully avoid child welfare intervention at all, or if child welfare intervention is required in order to keep that child safe, to minimize the timeline that children experience an out-of-home placement. The underlying drive for us, of course, because our mission is child protection, is that we have to be sure we're doing this in a way that's safe. So not just at the expense of safety are we trying to reduce the number of children who experience foster care, but we're in fact keeping kids safer. And I'll show you some data that shows that our efforts thus far are paying off, and we particularly watch the re-abuse rate, the kids who have been hurt once, we substantiate an abuse or neglect claim, and then within 6 months, we substantiate another one. We're watching our rate in Oregon precipitously decline around re-abuse, even as we reduce our foster care rates. And what that is an indicator of to us is that we are, in fact, doing this safely. Another measure, of course, is that all children would benefit from our strategic efforts to reduce the number of kids who experience foster care. Again, I made the point, and we can get you these charts, that showed that for a while, we were reducing foster care generally, but only children who are white were benefiting from that. Children of color, their rates in foster care were not going down. And we need to be sure that we're watching all kids and all families so that there's equity in our system and that our strategies are equally effective. And if they need modification to be effective, that we modify those. We've also set strategic improvement goals around what it is that we feel is most important around our obligation for children who do need foster care. We believe, unfortunately, that there probably will always be a need for foster care. We wish that weren't the case. As I said earlier, one of our strategic goals, as you saw on the previous slide, is that if a child can't be with their parent, they should be with a family member, if at all possible. But that is still foster care if they're not with their parent and if the state has legal custody. And so as we look at what our obligations are, of course, our paramount obligation for any child who's been hurt by their own family is to keep them safe in the foster care system. So we want to eliminate abuse in foster care. We want to be sure that their mental health and physical health needs are being met and that if at all possible, and we had this conversation last week, that their placement is stable. These are the three primary things we believe that we can do to help improve their educational attainment, help them be reunified quickly with their family members, and help them get them on a path to success as kids who unfortunately have experienced trauma for no fault of their own. Our data is actually improving and has been for the last several years. We've been meeting our strategic goals in several areas. We saw a few minor setbacks last year, which we're currently analyzing. Our rate of decline in foster care began to slow down, and that we attribute, at least at this point, primarily to some of our to the economy and to what's going on in our communities with respect to the increase in the stress that families are facing. It's taken a little while for that to play out in the foster care system, which isn't that surprising, but it is something that we're looking at and we can come back and report back to you on. But just to highlight a few of these things, we have seen, as foster care has declined by over 20% in this state in the last 5 years, we've seen the reabuse rate go down. We've seen the number of children who leave foster care and who then have to come back also decline. We've, as I pointed out earlier, seen the overrepresentation of Native American children served in foster care go down by about 21%. We've seen a decline in entries for African American children. We've seen, we've really been making an effort to be to try and minimize the number of placements for kids in foster care. Two or fewer is, of course, one is always the goal, but sometimes when you go into a home, let's say, we get a phone call from the police department on a weekend, children have to be removed, can't be safely kept with a parent. They go into a foster care placement. It may take us a few days to locate a relative, and then they move into the relative home. We certainly wouldn't want to keep them with that stranger first placement just for the sake of keeping them in one placement. So we consider two to be really, you know, two or fewer the goal, so we give ourselves some room around that time to find relatives. That number of kids is going up. We're constantly working with the mental health system to be sure that our kids are getting mental health assessments and have comprehensive treatment plans. The rate of behavior and mental health issues in the general population for kids is about 20%. The rate for kids in foster care, remember, who have experienced abuse or neglect is closer to 80%. That's why that's such a big goal for us. Abuse in foster care is declining in Oregon. In fact, we're being looked at by other states. As an example, we have a whole strategic plan around safety and care that's been working for us very well. And although I showed you last week our dashboard around face-to-face contact, this is one of the primary ways that we keep children safe is by going out and seeing them in their foster care placement setting. I mentioned the stability issue with placements. We're also, of course, when kids have siblings, we want to keep them together. We work really hard at that. And the relative issue is incredibly important to us. So this slide 8 just shows you some data around the improvement efforts we've seen so far around our strategic plans with respect to relatives. We hope to see this number go up a lot in 2011. We redefined relative based on feedback from families. about the fact that for them, we had a pretty strict definition before now that really required you to be blood related in order to be considered a relative in our system. For many families, there are people with whom kids are close, who they consider aunties, or family members that are not necessarily blood related. We redefined relative to be certain what we were recognizing as a relative was someone who had a strong psychological attachment to a child. And so we expect to see our rates of relative placement go up for kids because it allows us more expansively to look at individuals that that family considers a relative. I talked a little bit about the disproportionality issue.
Thank you for since you're pausing, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you. Has the redefinition of relative been incorporated into the 2010 numbers, and is that an explanation of the change in percentage placed with a relative?
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, the new definition took effect, I believe, July 1 of 2010, so it could partially contribute. In addition to that, we have been working closely with the Commission on Children and Families for some time around a specific way of looking for families that allows us to leverage the internet and a more expansive kind of family, we call it family find, a more expansive look. And we've also tightened up our timelines around relative placements. We always felt like we had an ongoing obligation, I think, to look for relatives, and I'm sure someone behind me could say the specific longer term date. We've basically made it a priority in the very first couple weeks of a case to find relatives if we can, so we've front-ended that work. So a couple of different strategies relating to the increase that's already beginning, and we hope to increase it even more.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Widener, while we're stuck, would you like to ask?
Yes, since we may not have another chance. Just real quick, because I see where your focus is on putting them with a relative and everything, and then you were talking about trying to get them back with a parent as well. Do you take into consideration what your caseworkers tell you about a child going back? Say you have an infant that was taken from somebody and they lived with a foster family or a relative for a couple of years, and then would you take them and place them back with the mother who has no connection with the child whatsoever, or would you leave them with a family that wants to keep the child as part of their family?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, you know, some those cases where a child's been in foster care and a foster parent has established a strong attachment or connection to the child, and then that child, for whatever reason, whether it's placement with a relative or returning home to a parent, has to the recommendation of the team of people, and it's not just child welfare that influences this. That there's an entire process around cases and court reviews that is inclusive of attorneys and CASAs and citizen review boards and judges. But the issue of I know it's very difficult, let me just say this, for foster parents who've had physical custody of children, especially infants, for a year, where then the parent has met the conditions for return. They've been visiting with the child, and the child then is, goes home to a parent. All of those issues of attachment and connection are considered, but it is very hard. Remember, until a parent's rights are terminated, that parent has constitutional rights to that child. And so that's why the courts are so involved in our process, and it's never just one person making a recommendation or a decision. And a court would need to authorize a return to parent plan as in the best interest of that child. Sometimes that can mean that there are some very short-term agonizing consequences for a foster family and even for a child who's grown attached and is having then to transition back to a relative. But the perspective of the system when you look longitudinally at what happens with kids is really designed around a long-term best interest conversation. And there have been more and more studies about children, even children who have suffered very, very serious abuse, whose parental rights have been terminated, who then, upon reaching the age of majority, the first thing that they do is they look for their biological family. There are, I think, some inexplicable psychological and biological connections that children have with their parents. But again, that isn't only a child welfare decision that wouldn't just be a worker or a person who's making that decision. That's why these decisions, which are very hard and are life-altering, are made in a much larger context and larger setting.
Follow up. So I guess my question is the caseworker who handles the case with the people, do they take priority over a review board who has no personal involvement with it? So if you have one of your own caseworkers who's saying, no, this person is not fit to take these children back, do you take that into consideration? Do you take the number of children, say the mother or father was in drug abuse real heavy, and now they have seven children and they just got out of prison, do you give all seven children back to them to take care of in a one-bedroom apartment? I know I have four children, and I mean, they could drive you to drink sometimes, so if I'm trying to get clean, it probably wouldn't be a good idea for me to have all of them. So I'm wondering if that's the kind of stuff that you look at when you're placing the children back with the families, because I've seen a lot of cases, and it comes from your department, where children are placed back into families and go through horrendous abuse again just to get removed again, and now they have no base or foundation for their life whatsoever. So that's what I'm trying to get at, is the root of what you look at for judging whether or not a child should be going back with a parent.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, the standard for us is always best interest of the child, and every situation in a family is very, very different. Of course, the opinion of workers who've been working with the family is taken most seriously into consideration, and what I'd be happy to do is come back. Lois Day was supposed to have been here today. My history actually isn't as a child welfare worker. If she were here, she'd probably be better at answering your question in terms of how those factors are weighed. What I would say is this, though. The legal standard is best interest. Parents who've had their children removed have very clear plans around conditions for return that require not just things like attend five treatment classes, but actually require behavior change of the parent to be demonstrable and that people can then come into court and testify to. So there's a very complicated way, I think, of handling each family's unique situation. And there are, of course, situations where Unfortunately, parents are given opportunities to be successful and they don't succeed. And those are always the ones that we want to be able to learn from. But I'd be happy to come with, if I could offer this, to have Lois Day and myself come meet with you and talk with you more about reunification and what some of the specific standards are for that and what some of the things are specifically that we look at.
Mr. Chair, I would like us to follow up on this because I've seen the cases and the instances with being a foster parent where they removed a child after the mother went through a six-month evaluation, and we've taken the child back, and the child had to go through stages where they were living on a very substantial environment that they were placed back into and removed again from the family, and now the children are suffering tremendously from it. So I think we need to look at the criteria of what these children are being placed back into and put the children first rather than the parents. So I would like to follow up on this.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, we'd be happy to do that. And the one thing I will say, and I think as myself being a parent, one of the things that becomes really difficult about these cases is that, remember, we're dealing with a parent's constitutional rights here, and the standard around the capacity and the quality of a parent is minimally adequate. That's the legal standard. And for many of us, some families, even in our own communities, are, as we look at it through our own lens and filter, that standard is a hard one to take when you think about children and how valuable and important they are. But it really comes back to the rights of parents, but also the rights of children to be protected and be safe. And both are considered in these conversations, so we'd be happy to get back to you. And I apologize that I'm not answering the question in a way that's helpful to you right now.
Let's continue with this, if you would, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much. I'm sitting here thinking back of my experiences on this committee over 8 years on and off now. And it must be very frustrating to sit out there long before Aaron was there, because in some committee hearings when we're on this, the committee members will say, we just have to protect families. We have to make sure, you know, and read a letter like, yeah, it's true, my daughter is fallen off her recovery and is working as a prostitute in Chicago, but my son-in-law is about to get out of prison, and after five terms he's probably learned his lesson, And you really need to make sure that the rights of this family are understood and that kid needs to be put back into the family. I mean, that's almost not an exaggeration. On the one hand, and then sometimes it's, we really need to protect the kid, and we really need to make sure kids aren't put back into families where they're at risk. And the issue is that I think it's what Aaron is trying to express now. It's that balance is a terribly hard balance, and they'll get information on both sides of it from us, and I think we need to be a little cautious about it. And Jim, I'm not speaking specifically about what you're talking about. I mean, what you're saying is exactly right. We need to make sure kids don't get ping-ponged in and out of good and bad situations. But then we also have to think about their job, which is a really tough job in this thing. You know, that kid that got killed in Mexico came about because of the pressure we put on Children Protective Services to get kids back with families. So that kid was put back with a family and then killed, unfortunately, and then the division is the one that's that's, why did you do that? Well, partly they do that is because we gave them instructions. So this is a very tough job that they're dealing with, Mr. Chair, and we need to be very cautious of that, I think, as you so well know.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. And I think we all are realizing, the longer we're on this committee, how this portion, not that there's everything else that DHS is doing is not important, but this portion particularly touches this. The hypotheticals are endless, let alone the actual examples from each one of our districts. All the more reason for this overview, and I would remind the committee that pieces of this, of what we're doing, are in the bills that we heard on Friday and that we'll consider later today. So this overview is very important, and if it's okay, I think we need to move on and continue with it.
I did mention the issue around, I just thought it was important that we have clarity together about what the department defines as disproportionality and disparities. And I've already pointed to that data, which will get you some more. Oh, is some of it's in here? I'd forgotten. I've been so focused on the next series of slides. And so, Representative Harker, maybe this will in part answer your question, although I think you're asking a little bit more for a little bit more information about the overall rates. But this will show you more specifically the number of children by race served in foster care between 07 and 2009. And then you can see specifically what was happening as the demographics in Oregon, in fact, are changing. One of the things that I think is often asked is this issue of sort of what's unknown or not recorded. We've been working very, very hard. Sometimes when you get a phone call regarding abuse or neglect and you then begin the process of intervening in the life of a family, the first question you're asking is not, how do you identify yourself in terms of your race or ethnicity? And so we've been making every effort to go back and make sure that we're getting that question answered from families so that we can serve them better in a way that meets their cultural identity specifically. And so when someone's identifying themselves on the census, which is where that percent of Oregon's children data comes from, they wouldn't say unknown. They would have the opportunity to identify. The reason there are unknowns in our system is just simply because of the way the system works, and we are working to go back. This is just a quick couple of slides about some of the various efforts that we've been making that have resulted in those improvements. Probably every one of these could drive an entire conversation and has actually before now because some resulted from legislation that you've passed. You can see reference to bills embedded in our strategic improvement efforts that will help explain some of the policy direction that you have given us and how we've implemented it. And just in summary, because I do want to be able to get to this next piece, we really do understand that investment early not only saves families, it also saves resources, which is one of the conversations that I know as a state we want to be having this legislative session. How do we really begin to move away from a reactive sort of deficit-based model of human services intervention toward a more preventive, proactive model that helps families before they get into crisis, before children are hurt, to remain more safe and stable. And that's what I'm going to, I might use that if I could to segue into the self-sufficiency program's presentation, but let me stop there and see if there are any other questions on child welfare, which I'm happy to come back and talk more with the committee about at any time.
The next part would be on which?
So the last major program area, sorry, Co-Chair Gilliam, is self-sufficiency programs that is inclusive of our temporary assistance for needy families, employment-related daycare, food stamps.
Any questions on this first part, then? Other questions? You know, I just make a comment that you don't necessarily have to respond to, but I will return to this theme often in this committee, and that's my hope that we can call on as many of our professionals in the private field and our nonprofits in the private field to assist. Clearly, you're doing that when you are looking for family members who are eligible and available with these kids. Could you just, you don't have to, but if you want to say something about what are we doing in this area to involve the nonprofit community, whether it's faith-based or community-based or whatever it is, to assist with the area of abused, neglected, and foster care kids.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee. This is one of our strategic efforts, and I will see if I can. It was here on the bottom of this slide, the Casey Partnership, communities, courts coming together in support. A couple of years ago, well, first let me say this. We do employ state employees who provide the protection and oversight services and monitoring around our child welfare and foster care system. However, when it comes to serving families, meeting their drug and alcohol addiction issues, mentoring parents, foster parents, we depend entirely on people outside ourselves to provide those services. In addition, we have entered into a strategic partnership around the efforts to safely and equitably reduce foster care in communities. Specifically, we've started in 8 counties, although our strategic goals for child welfare span our statewide offices. We started in 8 counties, I'll show you them in a couple minutes, in strategic partnership with the Commission on Children and Families and also with Casey Family Programs, which is the national foundation having expertise around child welfare issues. We are getting lots of technical assistance in addition to a small amount of money each biennium from the Casey Family Programs group. They're also leveraging this partnership with the courts. The Chief Justice, Paul DeMunis, has actually signed on to the priority of safely and equitably reducing foster care as one the courts are supporting with us. CASA program is engaged with us on this. The citizen review boards are engaged with us. And as part of that, then, we've done several things. We've expanded our ability to do outreach to relatives. We're just this month launching a campaign and a website in each of those communities. The campaign is designed to be public service announcements about what long-term foster care can mean to the detriment of some kids. And it has, in other places where it's been piloted, driven folks to want to act and be supportive in the community, just citizens or whomever. They go to the website, and on that website, in that community, faith-based organizations, CASA, nonprofits like Children First,
would
and others.
Would you remind everybody what CASA is?
A court-appointed special advocate. I apologize. They have several things, I think, have that acronym, and I'm so myopic in my view. Court-appointed special advocates are nonprofits in communities. The State Commission on Children and Families administers some state money that is directed to that program. They then leverage and generate volunteers who become guardian ad litem in court processes on behalf of children and their best interests who are in foster care. So we have a very extensive outreach effort, which we're then hopefully going to even begin to grow more with this website we call it's the Raise Me Up campaign. And we're really encouraging people, not everyone needs to be a foster parent in order to support a foster child, and there are many other ways to become involved. I think I'd given last week an example of our connection to the faith community and how they are helping families get housing. And so we're very invigorated and excited, and we really believe that without a very holistic, community-centric approach to this, we won't be successful.
Great. That's very encouraging. Representative Parrish.
Hi, thank you. you know, on Wednesday we heard Dr. Goldberg, and I specifically asked him a question about what do cuts to this budget look like, and I just heard you describe what the NGOs are doing, and his response was pretty much that those cuts would be in the delivery of that frontline service. And I guess I'm going to just kind of continue to press, you know, what, in the face of budget shortfall, how do we look at DHS, and where are some, you know, additional possibilities to streamline so that those dollars really hit where the rubber meets the road, which is where, you know, those kids and families need the support. Because when I look at NGOs, and I've certainly done my fair share talking to a bunch of them and been involved long before coming to this committee in the legislature in some of that type of work, that you look at how nimble and flexible some of those groups are and what they can get done with these dollars, and I have a real strong concern when the answer I got was, well, we'll just look at cutting delivery of services and reducing payments to people, that is the answer. That's not the answer I want to hear. So I'm hopeful, and this is not necessarily a question, but I just a comment to take back and think about is, you know, given a budget shortfall, how do we make sure that we don't do that and we look within, you know, pockets in the agency where we can streamline things? I have heard from folks in the nonprofit, faith-based world that they think that there is still room for some streamlining based on how they work with DHS, and that's something that I would like to, you know, have us continue to explore. So,
thank you, Representative.
So if I hopefully am able to navigate this quickly, I will shift gears then to the conversation about our self-sufficiency programs, part of which I was alluding to as it relates to that direct crossover between the conversation about children and families that we have in our division. And I'll do my best to go through this. So just beginning with the conversation again about poverty, and I just thought it would be important, and these are the eight counties. The reason they're called out here is that these are the eight counties. Looking at our strategic partnerships in communities that we've been really focusing on, and so I highlighted them in these county poverty rates at the bottom. But looking again at the issue of poverty and its influence over the, I think Dr. Goldberg on last week had mentioned that when in the response to the question about caseload drivers for CAF, for primarily the Children, Adults, and Families programs, looking at self-sufficiency and child welfare, one of the biggest drivers is the economy. And I wanted to be sure folks had perspective on what it looks like to live in poverty in Oregon, and also what it looks like not just to live in poverty, but also in extreme poverty, because the programs, one of the big programs I'm about to talk with you about, temporary assistance for needy families, to be eligible, you must be living in extreme poverty, which nationally is defined as under 50% of the federal poverty level. For Oregon, the TANF program, I'll show you the eligibility criteria is actually closer to 40%, 40. I also thought it was important, as we just got off the conversation about equity and disparities, to look at child poverty rates for kids of color. They are nationally significantly higher. I wasn't able to find specific data to Oregon. But when you look at things like the education gap and some of the downstream consequences of what it looks like for a child who's struggling to get to school because they're hungry, they can't learn, they're not getting the medical care that they need. There are big consequences down the road for us in terms of education and employment outcomes. And when and thinking about the Education Committee and their hearing about the education gap, it's again a lot around some of these very vulnerable underserved communities. And when you look at their poverty rates, they're extraordinarily high. Conversely, when you look at their rate of access to services like mental health care, addiction treatment, it's also extraordinarily low. So we do have an opportunity, I think, to have some conversation about these communities and what a prevention strategy can look like and what some of our, how we may be able, again, to shift our dynamic from the higher cost kinds of interventions to lower cost preventive models. I thought it would be good to show, this program area of self-sufficiency is really about two basic things. It's about meeting people's most basic hierarchical needs, food, shelter, able to care for themselves, and also then about getting them to employment so they can help themselves. And I wanted to take a look at three of our most, our largest programs. We don't administer the Oregon Health Plan, but we do
help people qualify for it through our eligibility services. And when you look at the families, over 1 million people in a year's time in Oregon served in self-sufficiency programs, the vast majority of them are being served by multiple programs. And I just thought this was a good visual to see that particular dynamic around those different programs. Just thought I would start with our food stamp program, which is, you know, one of the opportunities that we have to support families meeting their food needs in their household. It's designed as a supplement. It never was intended by the federal government to provide the entirety of a family's food budget. It's the caseload in this program has been going up dramatically during the recession. Many recipients of these nutrition benefits are children, and these slides are designed to just give you a sense of how many children, particularly young children, and their households depend on SNAP benefits to meet their nutrition needs. For perspective, one of the things I think that always is important to keep in mind is that the benefit of food stamps is 100% federal dollars. So although the federal government requires Oregon to invest 50% in the administrative costs for food stamps, the food stamp benefits themselves are 100% federal funds. That doesn't mean we take any less seriously our obligation to administer them well. They're still taxpayer money. But it does mean that it does generate economic activity for Oregon that isn't general fund generated. It's actually federal fund generated. And there's quite a bit of economic activity for grocers and many other small businesses that is generated from the food purchases that happen through the SNAP program. Thought it would be helpful to see that the overall benefit of food through SNAP is around $238 on average in January. But looking at a household of three, it was actually a slightly higher number. The average benefit per person was around $127 per month. That's about $4.25 per day per person to supplement a meal. Just helps, I think, sometimes to think about. Then you think about some of us who are caffeine dependent and buy a cup of coffee versus what folks on the food stamp program are needing in order to feed themselves and their families. I had the privilege actually of working with some families a couple of years ago living on an average food stamp budget, myself and my family for the week. Some folks helped take us shopping and had the experience of what is it like to really try and manage your budget in a much smaller way and also meet your family's nutritional needs. And it was a very eye-opening experience for me, knowing that most of our families who are living in poverty are working, and I would say, and many have children, and I would say for our family, going shopping with children took a lot longer when you were trying to maximize your food budget. Children in the grocery store for a very, very, very long time trying to find the food that was the least expensive that would require, you know, that would meet our family's household needs and manage to our budget, having to think about that. And then the amount of preparation and other activity that went into preparing and actually eating for that week was extraordinary. I mean, small things that our family has grown to take for granted, we couldn't that week, and it was just very enlightening. And I guess I would also say that also enlightening for us that at that point in time was that we had many state employees who emailed us to let us know that they were actually on food stamps because of their state employee salaries were. Maybe they were a temporary employee, they weren't receiving health benefits, those kinds of things, and they were relying on food stamps. And so there was a really active and engaging conversation about who is on food stamps and what is it really like to live on a food stamp budget? How do you provide adequate nutrition for your family living at that budget level? We have a whole strategic plan, which we'd be happy to share with you, but I knew we wouldn't have time today, around the fact that, going back to that slide, looking at the fact that so many families are both using food stamp benefits and accessing the Oregon Health Plan, we recognize we have a really unique opportunity to positively influence the nutrition of those families and maybe impact the obesity issue and impact their health in a better way. And so some of our strategic efforts around the food stamp program have been working with the nonprofit community to try and with physicians in the physician community, the Oregon Food Bank, the Hunger Task Force, many others, schools, to help us improve the quality of food that people are eating in these programs.
Can I just ask you quickly, what indication do you have from the federal government about the level of support for that, for food stamps in the next biennium?
Continued support, however, there was an increase in the benefit amount for food stamps, which the federal government approved through the stimulus resource. And we did, on this last bullet, you can see recently, there is an act currently under consideration that would roll back some of that increase by reducing benefits on average of about $60 per household.
And can I ask you, how much longer do you think we are in this overview? I'm trying to manage the time, and Representative Gelser's here. I don't know how her.
I'm happy to stop if you want to take.
How's your schedule, Representative Gelser?
I can be flexible until we go to the floor.
Okay, good. Let's continue.
Thank you. I will, Chair Gilliam. I will. I'm hoping to get done in 10 minutes.
Thank you.
We've talked a little bit about the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program and who it serves. Again, very, very low-income families, parents with children living in extreme poverty. Just for perspective, that's about $616 per month. And also for perspective, when we provide cash assistance to them at the same time that we're providing them job supports, the cash assistance is the maximum cash assistance level is about $506 per month, and that is basically giving that household an income which allows them to live at about 33% of the federal poverty level. And so I think it's just important to keep in mind that the incentive for people, particularly in Oregon, is not to come on to TANF. For a family of, for a parent, a single mom with two children, working 17 hours a week at minimum wage will disqualify you from TANF eligibility. One of the key elements of our TANF program, in addition to providing family and economic stability, really trying to continue to stabilize the household, economically meet basic needs, is our jobs program. That's an employment and training program. Again, the goal being that folks would be on TANF a minimal amount of time and then be able to help themselves through employment. We have had to, over the last biennium, because of the caseload increases and the reduced funding levels, reduce that program significantly, and I'll talk more about that. Even though we say 40% of the federal poverty level is the eligibility criteria, a survey of all our families shows us that 96% of them actually have zero earnings by the time those parents with children come onto the TANF program. Many of them have disabilities. That can be a cognitive or learning disability. It can also be a mental health issue. And that requires a different approach to helping them obtain employment. That's the point of understanding that issue.
Karen, I want to interrupt you one more time. I was talking with the co-chair here for a second. We both feel this is not a hurry-up kind of a briefing. This is our intent, having you come, which you've fulfilled, is to bring us some good information, and we don't want to just hurry up. Is it possible if we stopped here to invite you back to finish this presentation?
Of course.
All right with you?
Sure, of course.
Is that okay?
Yes, I think that's good.
Then, if this is a good, I've interrupted you, but if this is a good stopping point, maybe we can. Unless you have a final thought for today, we'll reschedule for the rest.
Co-chairs, that's more than fine. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much, not just for today, but for the last couple of hearings. We appreciate your information very much. To that end, committee, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the Department of Human Services, and I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2460, and I'd like to ask our colleague, Representative Gelser, to join us here at the podium. Before you get started, Representative Gelser, I'm going to ask Representative Frederick, who has an unbelievable voice, to read the committee summary. Just a little thing I'd like to do. So is this it here?
You're welcome to share mine.
What do you want me to read?
I think you should sing it.
No.
I would like the representative
the whole
to read.
Thing here.
We're going to pass this around each time. And now it's Representative Frederick's turn to do the committee summary.
Thank you. Is this an audition? Is that what I'm doing?
Okay.
thank you very much, Representative. What the measure does, repeals the sunset on the exemption of alcohol and drug treatment providers from disqualification based upon criminal conviction, incorporates and aligns definition terms to provisions under Oregon Revised Statutes, ORS 443, exempts alcohol and or drug treatment providers from reporting requirements for elder abuse from the and from the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority records check requirement. Okay. The background, you want the background as well? Well, you just need the...
What do you think?
Sure.
Let's do the background.
You're getting warmed up.
I'm getting warmed up. My voice is getting warmed up. Thank you. Background. A fall article in the Oregonian revealed that one in five adults with a developmental disability was abused between 2000 and 2007. A significant number of these individuals were abused more than once. According to data reported by the Office of Investigation and Training, only about 15% of serious cases of abuse referred to law enforcement received follow-up. In the 2009 regular legislative session, HB 2242B was signed into law and became effective July 28, 2009. HB 2442B established the Quality Care Fund and designated the fund to the Department of Human Services for training, technical assistance, quality improvement, and licensing. The bill added DHS reporting requirements for individuals receiving developmental disability services and established facility notification requirements when DHS substantiated an abuse allegation in a facility. HB 2442B required a criminal records check on employees of facilities, care agencies, home health agencies, or certain individuals paid directly or indirectly with public funds and precluded public funding of employees convicted of certain crimes. The bill required DHS to establish policies, procedures, and guidelines for abuse investigations and investigators to include until January 2015 county multidisciplinary teams developed by each county district attorney. DHS and law enforcement agency investigation requirements were expanded. HB 2442B increased fees and civil penalties for facilities serving persons who are elderly, have physical disabilities, or have developmental disabilities, requiring the monies to be deposited in the Quality Care Fund. Will that do, sir?
Perfect. Thank you, Representative. Now, Representative Yeltsin, welcome. Before we take
that,
your...
That proved this can be just as boring with a good voice.
Uncalled for. Maybe true. Before you get started, I want to tell you a little bit about this committee. This is the Human Services Committee.
Oh.
Are you familiar with that?
I've never heard of it.
Well, I think you're going to enjoy it. Now we're ready for your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei. Thank you very much for taking the time to schedule this hearing early. And thank you to Representative Frederick for doing such a thorough background of House Bill 2442, which is something I'm very proud to have worked on. And I'm so grateful to so many of you to help for helping to pass into law in 2009. We're doing good things for some very vulnerable Oregonians because of that. In 2009, after 2 years of work that involved dozens of people and literally dozens of stakeholder groups. I think we had 31 different public input meetings on the different provisions of the expansive legislation. The Oregon legislature did pass sweeping reforms to improve the safety of individuals receiving direct care services through our aging, physical disability, and developmental disability programs. These reforms enhanced transparency when abuse occurs, created stiffer penalties for substantiated abuse, improved definitions of abuse, and created better coordination with the justice system to improve the prosecution of crime committed against our most vulnerable neighbors. And I've heard anecdotally from Washington County, for instance, that this legislation has been key in increasing the number of prosecutions of rapes and financial mismanagement of vulnerable people, and I'm very pleased to hear that. The legislation also worked to ensure the safety of the workforce by including a very narrow list of crimes that would make a person ineligible to provide direct care to very vulnerable people. This is very similar to the list of exclusions that is in our public school system, only the list of crimes is much smaller for this adult population than what we have in our public school. And the idea was that if we had certain types of exclusions when people were going to be caring for large numbers of fully dressed children in very public places, we should have similar protections for nonverbal adults who are cared for naked behind closed doors. Implementation of this law is underway, and thanks to all who helped to make it a reality. During the implementation of the law, it became apparent that there was a drafting error that inadvertently included drug and alcohol treatment providers in the category of workers impacted by the criminal exclusions. This was never intended to be in House Bill 2442. Because some of the very best drug and alcohol treatment providers have a history of substance abuse themselves, it is not unusual that some of these same workers may have committed some of these very serious crimes before they began their recovery. Their experience is critical
to building a quality alcohol and drug recovery workforce, and not correcting this error would be detrimental not just to those workers, but most importantly, to others in recovery who can benefit from the experience of these counselors and see the hope that lays before them as they go through recovery by meeting others who are in similar circumstances to themselves. In 2010, we took temporary action to delay implementation of this measure in the A&D system so that we could carefully craft the permanent fix. And that fix is sitting before you in House Bill 2460. This legislation will exempt all drug and alcohol providers from the exclusions and will also exempt all workers employed by facilities duly licensed to provide drug and alcohol and mental health services. And I've provided you with a copy of the Legislative Council opinion that confirms that this is true. I would suggest one further amendment that would improve this legislation that is also before you. And this amendment would allow the fitness determination that is used during the criminal background checks that will still take place for drug and alcohol providers to be stored at the request of the employee to save time when a drug and alcohol provider moves from a facility or to a new client. This creates a great administrative efficiency and also underscores that we expect that people will still be receiving criminal background checks. I do not support any other recommended amendments to exclude workers in other service areas from the criminal exclusions. There's a very clear nexus on this issue with drug and alcohol providers. But it is our duty as policymakers to make choices that protect the very most vulnerable among us. Individuals relying on direct care workers to manage finances, provide the most intimate care services, and care for them behind locked doors need the protections of House Bill 2442. Unfortunately, we still have much work to do to combat abuse against those who are aging or living with mental illness, developmental or physical disabilities. This is not the time to roll back those protections that we've worked so hard to receive, to achieve for these populations. I thank you again for considering this bill. I hope that you will schedule a work session soon to adopt the needed amendment and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Rapid movement on this bill will provide much needed certainty for clients and workers in our alcohol and drug treatment system. And I'm happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Representative Gelser, to be clear, the bill in 09 was 2442. It's now statute.
Correct.
2460, I don't want to put words in your mouth, corrects an unintended omission from that bill.
Correct.
And you're supporting the dash one in addition to that?
Correct.
Okay. Are there questions for Representative Gelser? Representative Frederick?
No particular questions. Welcome again. I just want to thank you for putting this forward. I have had enough relatives and friends who are either helping with people in recovery or are in recovery themselves. And they know that, in fact, the people who are some of the best folks to come forward are the ones who have been through the system. And this, I've had now at least 30 different folks come forward to tell me that this has created some significant problems with staffing, with careers, and this really will help the people who are being treated. So again, thank you very much for this.
Thank you. And Representative Frederick, one thing that is important to point out is there are cases where that is true in the mental health system as well. We worked so hard on that in 2442 that current law allows for peer counseling and peer treatment for individuals who have gone through the mental health system and are now in the position of peer counselors. So those people are also protected and in current law already excluded from those provisions.
Again, thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gelser, can you work us through exactly how it does that in terms of the bill?
Sure. And, you know, I brought this big pile of papers, and now that we are paperless, I realized I did not bring the bill.
But I can tell you
what it does is it says that they are exempt from the section of law that says if you are convicted of this particular list of crimes, you are no longer excluded from providing services. People are so responsive here.
Here, take mine.
You'd give me the bill off your table?
I would give you the bill off my table.
Thank
bill
you.
Off his back.
So if you look at section, let me find the right spot. If you look at section 2 and you go to page 4 and you look at lines 7 through 9,
It says subsection 2 of this section, and if you look back, if you look down underneath that where you start to see subsection 2, you see the public funds cannot be used to support in whole or in part.
Hold on.
Okay.
I'm in the electronic version. I'm having trouble figuring out which page is which. So
right.
Page 4, I believe. There is page 1.
So page 4, and I actually gave you the wrong line. Line 27 and 28. Just adds the language where we list the people who are not covered in lines 13 through 17 from being denied the ability to be employed to provide direct care services. It adds an employee of a residential facility or residential treatment home that is licensed under ORS 443.415 to provide for individuals with alcohol and or drug dependence. And you'll note in the line right above that, a peer support specialist, that is the mental health exception that I mentioned previously.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Hold on.
Does this only cover inpatient people to begin with? Is that so? An outpatient substance abuse treatment worker is not excluded from their job because of the...
With the passage of this legislation, no worker, inpatient or outpatient, would be excluded from working in the drug and alcohol treatment system on the basis of having these convictions.
But this is only about residential.
The drafting error did not exempt, my understanding, the day treatment providers.
Okay. So that's going to be picked up with the amendment, is that
correct? What the amendment picks up is that it allows, even though these crimes aren't going to permanently exclude these individuals from employment, their employer is probably still going to run a background check, and this allows that the health authority or the department to maintain that fitness determination, so they don't have to keep doing the same work over and over again every time someone moves an employer. It's an administrative efficiency.
Representative Parrish.
Actually, she just answered my question. That was the piece I wanted to know. Essentially, this isn't saying we're not going to look at people's backgrounds and identify. The bill simply is just saying that if somebody does have a crime in their past, that they still could be eligible for work, but we're still essentially going to look and see what's in people's past so we know who we're pairing up with folks as they're either peer-to-peer or as they're getting treatment from people who work in facilities.
Correct.
I heard you say that.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, Representative Parrish, that is correct. And it's important to make the clarification that even for those that are excluded, it is a very narrow list of crimes. Not everybody is excluded forever having had a criminal record. The one other thing that I failed to mention, and I know someone is going to testify about this in a minute, this bill also removes drug and alcohol treatment providers from the list of individuals that are mandatory reporters for elderly and for reporting suspected abuse of elderly and disabled individuals. The thinking and the reason behind that is the reason public school teachers are mandatory reporters of child abuse or legislators are mandatory reporters for abuse is that we have consistent ongoing communication that might put us in a position to have a greater awareness of these things taking place. It was inadvertent that these individuals were put into the elderly abuse reporting statute. Drug and alcohol providers have no specific expertise in elder or disability-based abuse. They have no heightened access to information about what's going on in the care of these vulnerable individuals. It is not a population that is currently served by OIT to do investigations based on this point of mandatory reporters, so it was another piece that the Department of Human Services identified that should be corrected while we're doing this work.
And that's contained in 2460 as well?
Correct.
That answer yours? Mm-hmm. Just a second. Representative Harker.
I'm all set. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one here, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of stuff in here, but it looks like the core is verbal abuse, financial exploitation, and sexual abuse are the three that you are not wanting to be involved with in-home caregiving when I get to the bottom, or as I'm reading through this, but I may need some more help getting through the whole bill because I didn't get a chance to read this beforehand. So, because verbal abuse. I'm just wondering what that is, because sometimes I get verbally abused from the chairs of these committees, too. So,
I appreciate that. Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, Representative Widener, this bill does nothing to change definitions of abuse in any way. This is about these criminal exclusions. I will say that verbal abuse in vulnerable populations is a very serious matter. If you are a person with a cognitive disability and somebody who is inserting a catheter in you or you rely on for food is calling you retarded or threatening to kill you, that is a very serious problem, and that is why verbal abuse is considered abuse under our statutes.
Okay.
Yes, I got it.
Very nice question. Very well done.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
That's a form of subtle verbal abuse.
I think so. Absolutely.
Thank you. I'm a little slow today. I'm not sure why. I guess I haven't warmed up through the week. Let me try again.
Could be the chair.
This is me. The only change I see in here besides those definitions is in this, or the major one, is in this line 27, 28, 29, which excludes employees of a residential treatment facility or residential treatment home. It does not exclude outpatient treatment of substance abuse. So my question is, were employees of an outpatient program of substance abuse not swept into this to begin with? Are they exempt already, or is there somewhere else in this bill that exempts them?
Representative Gilliam, Representative Tomei, Representative Greenlick, I believe that that the department is here and can probably answer that question more carefully. I can tell you we worked very hard on this in the interim to be very careful that it picked up all the people that we wanted to pick up, and I think they can speak more elegantly to why this makes sure that outpatient is covered as well.
Any other questions for Representative Gelser? If not, we thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Moving along, I would like to call Bradbury, Richard Harris, and Jonathan Eames up. There are three. If there are others, you need to identify yourself, but I think these are the three that we have on the list to testify.
May I close this?
Can we close that?
Yeah, okay.
And if you want to self-select and begin by identifying yourself, we'll be grateful.
Okay, I'll self-select.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairs Gilliam and Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Brad Berry. I'm the district attorney for Yamhill County, Oregon. Representative Widener is my representative. Nice to see you, sir. And I also am here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association as I chair their legislative committee. House Bill 2460, as Representative Gelser mentioned, covers a couple of things, and the issue that the district attorneys had were twofold. One actually has been addressed by the amendments relating to the ability of employers to run criminal background checks on individuals who may be giving services in a residential treatment facility or residential treatment home, as is defined in the bill and by statute. The concern we had, and obviously it's been taken care of, is we certainly understand that many people involved in A&D treatment have criminal backgrounds. They, in fact, have been involved in alcohol or other substance abuse. Many of them have come through recovery. Many of them turn their experiences into helping others to become clean. And I will tell you that I'm very familiar with this. I actually physically man one of our several drug courts in my county, dealing with the highest risk individuals, and watch the success they've had with some individuals who know how to give treatment because they've been there, and we recognize that. Secondly, I've chaired the Yamhill County Local Alcohol and Drug Planning Council for over 15 years, and have had the opportunity to deal both with treatment providers as well as involve treatment receivers within that committee so that we have the best possible programs we can in our county. So just I want you to be aware that I'm very familiar with it. The other issue, though, that causes concerns, and I'll go back to my notes now since the first half of them got thrown out. The other part deals with elder abuse reporting. As Representative Gelser mentioned, the mandatory reporting portion of this of elder abuse appeared to have been an unintended consequence of, was it 2422? However, I would suggest that it is a good thing to have there. First, according to the American Psychological Association, there are 2.1 million older Americans who suffer abuse, and this is either through neglect, actual physical abuse, sexual abuse, or what we often see for those in my business, financial exploitation and financial abuse. And the estimate there is that some 5 cases go unreported for every case that is reported. So the numbers are much greater than that, I would suggest. Incidentally, those numbers, as I was researching this, come from a study from 2004. And with the aging population in this country, I would suggest those numbers have only gotten higher and that they're probably outdated. In my experience, we have seen individuals who prey on the elderly, in particular financial fraud, exploiting them to the point of making them penniless in the golden years of their lives. And it is not uncommon, and this is somewhat anecdotal now from my own county, that it happens from individuals who have drug or alcohol and substance abuse issues. The point here is this, that that 2460, if in fact someone providing services like a doctor, like a nurse, like a psychologist, all of those who are mandatory reporters, should they come in, have knowledge or suspicion that elder abuse has occurred, all the current obligation is that they have to report it, and they have to report it to their employer. That would create an investigation. Typically, that would then be reported to law enforcement by the employer. I don't see the downside to that. These cases so rarely come up, especially in the area of financial exploitation, that if in fact a genuine suspicion were to arise, I don't see the downside in reporting it. Because the other side of it, the not reporting, I have knowledge and keep it to myself. The other side is we run the risk that someone will be penniless down the road, someone will continue to be abused, because all of these folks come out of substance abuse at some point. Hopefully in a very much better place than they otherwise would be in. But many blow out of treatment. They are unsuccessful in treatment. And I think we ignore the alarm going off by not requiring the mandatory reporting. Lastly, and I think this is really important for you to note, if you look at the definition of those now who would be excised from the mandatory report, and this is found on page... I don't have my glasses on page 4. Thank you. Those who are excised. It talks about any employee of a residential treatment facility or a residential treatment home. And many of these facilities have employees who are physicians, who are nurses, who are psychologists, who otherwise have mandatory reporting requirements by having that license. They would, if they are an employee, at least arguably, and acting in their employment there, be excised along with these other folks that they're attempting to remove from the mandatory reporting requirement. I would suggest that that's unintended here. There's no intent, I think, as Representative Gelser mentioned, to have these people not have their other mandatory reporting requirements. But, in fact, there's an argument there by the wording of the statute insofar as they're an employee of one of these facilities. So, in sum, I would say maintaining the mandatory reporting requirement is beneficial to those who are, to the elderly in our population who are most seriously abused and taken advantage of. And, in fact, we don't want to excise people who are otherwise not intended. Thank you.
Any questions at this point? If not, let's move on. Jonathan, you want to? Okay. Mr. Harris, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam and Tomei, and members of the committee. My name is Richard Harris. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Health Authority for Addictions and Mental Health, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 2460. HB 2442, passed during the 2009 legislative session, created an exclusionary crimes list that previous individuals convicted of any of the listed crimes from employment within publicly funded programs serving vulnerable populations, residential alcohol and drug treatment facility or treatment home employees were originally included in that bill. We've worked closely with Representative Gelser to try to make this fix, as you heard earlier today. The new bill seeks to change permanently the statutory language excluding employees of residential treatment facilities or residential treatment homes. The bill also ensures potential employees of such facilities are not denied employment solely based on the list of exclusionary crimes. During the special February session in 2010, there was a temporary modification, and it was implemented and will sunset in July 1, 2011, unless we make this a permanent exception. AMH, Addictions and the Mental Health Division, supports HB 4262 as residential and alcohol and drug treatment centers will not be required to exclude potential employees who have previous criminal histories involving certain crimes. In addition, individuals in recovery with conviction of certain crimes will not be excluded from working in residential alcohol and drug treatment centers based solely on their criminal history. AMH recognizes the importance of ensuring the health and safety of people receiving services from the agency while also encouraging working to protect and grow the recovery-oriented workforce in Oregon. As Oregon works to expand health care to more of its residents, the demand for residential alcohol and drug treatment will expand. A workforce including individuals in recovery serves the needs of the state of Oregon and the people we serve. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I would like to make a clarifying statement, Representative Greenlick, if I may. That is, initially, the bill was designed around residential programs and home caregivers and home services. It never has been in the statute that outpatient services would require a criminal background check. However, there will be criminal background checks required in the residential programs that serve children. And so there are a number of programs that we license that serve children, and they still have a mandatory requirement. Those are under the statutes governing children and families, not under the A&D statutes. As a provider of services for over 25 years in Portland and in my previous job, I would say that I understand quite thoroughly the importance of having recovering staff members to help people in becoming clean and sober and a recovering lifestyle. And it's extremely important that those individuals actually be sober and clean, and that they have changed the way they're managing their lives so they can help others to manage their lives. As a treatment provider who had a continuum of services including housing, health care, employment, and addiction services, we always did criminal background checks on every employee, whether they were in recovery or not. It was just a prudent business practice to make sure you knew who your workforce was. The person who in recovery frequently had a background which could have involved criminal activity, but in their new life as a recovering person certainly is not in that category any longer, and they are valuable workforce members in that whole process of getting people into recovery. So I would strongly urge the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Harris. I wonder if you had a comment on the issue that Mr. Berry brought up, the possible confusion, inadvertent or not, that might arise over folks who do have a mandatory requirement somehow either being confused or exempt from the requirement.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that when I heard the problem that's been identified here, and certainly we would not want employees who are mandatory reporters now to be exempted from that.
So it's possible we would need additional language to clear that up, in your mind?
If the committee thought it was necessary to do that, yes.
Okay.
Representative Gelser is shaking her head, yes.
Okay. She's still here. Oh, there she is. We hurried up for you, and you stayed with us. I'm very impressed. Okay, if there are other questions, we do. Representative Green.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just to clarify, Richard, 2442 did not sweep in outpatient AMD workers. It only included workers in residential treatment or residential or treatment home. Is that correct?
Co-chairs Gilliman, Tome, Representative Greenlick. No, it did not include outpatient to begin with.
Thank you. That's also a
dilemma. Any other questions? Let's move on, Jonathan.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames with Eames Consulting here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association, otherwise known as OPRA, and we're here to testify in support of House Bill 2460. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Gelser for bringing this bill forward. We've been working on this for a long time, over a couple of years now, trying to get the best language. You, in your wisdom, both the Senate of the House and the governor adopted a fix for it in 2010 temporarily to get us through June 30th of this year. Now we're at the point where we can, I think we can get some really good language to make this permanent. Number of you on the committee, I know, have worked with people with substance abuse problems, has worked at your local alcohol and drug treatment facility, and as OPRA, as the statewide association of alcohol and drug treatment facilities, we really appreciate your work on this, and I know you guys have a lot of experience with this. I won't belabor the point. I think a number of people here have already brought up the reasons why this is important, but from not only from an employer perspective, but also from people who care about treating people with substance abuse problems, the value of having someone who has had the substance abuse problems being able to interact with people who are coming into the treatment facility is just, it's immeasurable. And numerous times those folks do have issues. They've had issues in the past, some of them many years ago, and to exclude them from being able to treat and help others in, you know, one of the missions and charges of people who go through substance abuse programs is that they give back and they continue their work, and this fixes that problem. So we urge the passage of House Bill 2460. If there are individual language changes that need to be made, I've worked with Representative Kelser, and it's been a very good process. I think we'd be willing to take a look at that and see what we can do to make this bill the best it can be. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go through this because there's a few things that concern me a little bit. And offline, if I could meet with Mr. Berry, I would appreciate it just to talk to him about a couple things that are in this that are concerning me as well. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding everything properly.
Okay.
Chair Gilliam, if I might, one more thing I just want to add, that we've gone through our membership and asked them who does criminal background checks, and everyone that I surveyed do their own criminal background checks before they hire anybody to be part of their facility, their treatment facility. So I just wanted to make sure that was on the record, too.
Representative Widener, I'll stay in touch with you regarding your concerns after you have a chance to talk to the DA from your cabinet. If there are no other questions, at this point, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2460. And if the committee will be patient for a moment, the co-chairs are just going to stand at ease. We'll go offline for just about 2 minutes. You can take a two-minute break, but we'll be right back. I'm going to call the committee back to order. And committee members, we're going to, as time allows, I think we can do this, but we're going to begin looking at 2048, 2047, 2050 with the intention, after discussion, of moving to a vote on all three, depending on the time. So I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2048. And you can just have the measure summary.
Okay.
One more time, please.
Mr. Chair, this bill was originally heard by the committee on February 2nd. It clarifies that the Department of Human Services does not contract with nonprofit legal service organizations or lawyers to represent the state family pre-supplemental security income, Social Security Disability Insurance Program assistance in administrative hearings before the Social Security Administration, instead maintaining a list of and referring recipients to those services. Requires the recipients to sign an interim assistance reimbursement agreement when applying for supplemental security income benefits, and the measure would align the statute with current Social Security Administration policy. Subsequent to the hearing on the 2nd, we have received a fiscal impact statement, which indicates there's no fiscal impact, and we have a no revenue impact statement.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was particularly concerned about the last part that you talked about, and if we need clarification or discussion on any part of the bill, but specifically on the fiscal and the revenue impact, I'd be happy to entertain comments about that, and also mention that Mickey Cerise is in the room if we need further comment on that from the department. Do you have questions about that portion of the bill, that is the removal of the fiscal and the revenue impact? Then I'll leave that to rest. Is there discussion about the bill generally? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Madam I move Chair. That we vote on House Bill 2048 and send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Does removal and subsequent need to be part of the same?
I don't know.
Same motion?
Does that, the removal of the fiscal, does that need?
There is no fiscal. It's a no fiscal impact
so
statement.
You don't have
there
to.
Is no fiscal.
No, didn't this have a subsequent referral?
No, this one did not. No.
Possible, but did not. Representative Tomei has moved this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I now will ask the clerk, yes, to call the roll.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Parrish.
Aye.
Representative
Weiner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye.
Chair
Gillian. Aye. Motion has passed unanimously. This bill will go to the floor according to the co-speaker's schedule. And I would like to ask, don't have to, but would like to ask for volunteers to carry the bill, our first bill.
This consent calendar, so straightforward.
Oh, I think that's a great idea. I think Representative Greenland recommended that this be on the consent agenda.
Okay.
So with Representative Greenland's suggestion, recommendation that it be on the consent calendar, are there any objections? So ordered, we'll order it to the consent calendar. I would now like to close the work session on House Bill 2048 and open a work session on House Bill 2047. I will make a quick comment about this bill, colleagues, and say that in the discussion, I became convinced that this was a good bill, but I was concerned, I don't know if that's the right word, I wanted to make sure that we had communicated with the five schools that would be affected, and I have been assured that that has happened. So I'm open, first of all, to discussion about the bill. And I'd like to recap it in out of order, if you don't mind, by asking Jennifer to read the summary.
House Bill 2047, if you'll recall, was originally heard on February 4th, and it designates private residential boarding schools that provide academic education and therapeutic care as a child caring agency, which would be subject to the licensure requirements of the Department of Human Services. There's a the designation would enable the Department of Human Services to immediately remove children at risk of harm without an initial hearing. There's a no fiscal, no revenue impact statements on this bill.
Any other discussion, Representative Fritter?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to move that we support and this particular bill and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Frederick has moved that we pass House Bill 2047 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Parrish. Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Beamer.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thompson. Aye. Vice Chair Thompson. Aye. Aye. House Bill 2047 has passed unanimously and will be sent to the House with a due pass recommendation. Are there any recommendations regarding assignment of bill or consent calendar?
I think that one better be explained by somebody that understands it.
Mm-hmm. And bill passes, and I'd like volunteers for this bill if possible.
I would do that, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Tomei has volunteered for the assignment of our first bill. I think that's appropriate. I'd like to move to our last bill right after I close the work session on House Bill 2047. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2050. No, with the help I can get. Let's start with the recap of what the measure does.
Okay, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2050 was originally heard on February 4th. It amends and aligns the state statutory language for children who remain in child welfare custody to current federal statutory language, removes permanent foster care as an option for an out-of-home placement for a ward in the substitute care of the Department of Human Services, and it clarifies the term another planned permanent living arrangement as a permanency plan option for a ward in substitute care. There is a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Committee members, I would just say that in the discussion on this bill, you might term it semantics, but nonetheless, I thought that Representative Tomei had a very eloquent way of saying that we should, regardless of whether the bill does or doesn't recognize this, that we should underline our intent regarding permanency. And so we felt like that should at least be on the record at this point in the bill. So is there something you'd like to add about that? You were far more articulate than I was.
You're doing a great job. We just want to acknowledge that we are not doing away with permanent foster care.
Right.
We want that on the record. We are just making this change because the federal government does not recognize that phrase. What they want is another planned permanent living arrangement. In our view, that does include permanent foster care.
Other comments?
Mr. Co-Chair, this was my concern as well. I think I'm satisfied now. I have a major problem with the concept of removing an option, whatever that is, because to me that means you remove an option, but the explanation that's come down seems to make sense, so I'll be supportive of this, and I'll be very angry to find out later that we did remove an option, but so it better not happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Anger would be well placed. Other discussion on this bill? I would entertain a motion for its passage.
So moved.
Co-Chair Tomei moves the House Bill 2050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Parker.
Representative
Parker?
Aye.
Representative Harris?
Aye.
Representative
Weider? Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Funk?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 2050 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I will again ask for volunteers for carriage.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if this also couldn't go on the consent calendar, since it really is just corresponding with federal language rather than changing anything in Oregon law.
You know, I'm getting tired of you and Representative Greenlick railroading these things.
With that, Mr. Chair, I would be delighted to carry this bill for you.
Knowing, having a volunteer is one thing, but agreement that it should be consent calendar before we take the volunteer? We are in agreement. Hold that thought. There'll be other bills.
That was my
only
one.
So we agree that it will go on, that we'll recommend the consent calendar. And with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2050. And before I adjourn the committee, is there anything we need to say about?
I think that our intent is to carry over the informational hearing from Aaron Kelly Seal.
Yeah, we're going to carry that over and finish that. We both felt that that was extremely important to do. We do have a little extra time, but we didn't know that at the time. And we've posted for tomorrow, correct?
That's correct.
So you'll check that. Any other questions from committee members for Wednesday?
Could we maybe just appoint her as a permanent staff member of this committee? We'll hear her every day.
Yeah, I think we may have to get her a phone, set her up
right
here. All right, if there's nothing else, the House Committee on Human Services is adjourned.